Well, coming back to visit Wat Nanachat once more as ex-abbot, as a kind of elder statesman, I suppose, these days. It's usual for a lot of memories and reminiscences to pop up into my mind. One that occurred to me earlier today was of a time when Ajahn Amaro was visiting. At that time he was living in America, I believe, or even before that. And I was telling him that these days the personalities of the monks here was a lot blander than it was in the old days, and not so much conflict. And just as I finished saying this, a white-faced monk appeared at the mosquito screen underneath the Zenkebi's kuti. And the monk said, "Ajahn, I just punched Monk S." And he was so obviously so full of remorse that my initial response was to comfort him. And I said, "Well, I know he's very irritating monk at times, and I think probably everybody's felt like thumping him at one point or another." So I can understand how you finally reached your limit, because you sit next to him and you get this every day. And he said, "It wasn't once. I don't feel so bad about the first punch. It's the second one that I'm feeling guilty about." So I said, "Where did this happen?" He said, "It's on the path to the boat." So I walked out there, and the monk was still lying on the ground. And I could see that he had one eye to see when somebody was coming. And when he realized I was almost upon him, he wiped this smile off his face. And I realized what was going on, that these two monks, it often happens or used to happen, monks of the same pansars who sit close together become very competitive. It's this young man energy, and these two monks never got on very well. And this the monk who was laying on the ground was a very skilled stirrer. He knew how to stir people up, and the realization, if I can grace it with that word, was he'd won. He felt he'd won. That now, being the thumpee rather than the thumper, he would have the moral high ground for the rest of their monastic life together. He was always the one who'd been thumped. And the depth of the of that kind of manipulation and sort of cunning and unwholesome thinking was just quite stunning to me. I had no sympathy for him at all. He was just waiting to be discovered and hurts all over kind of thing. So we used to, every now and again, we used to have these kinds of dramas, and there was always something or other going on, not quite to that level, of course, but there is often a kind of a undercurrent of tension. I think particularly when, as they say, one, a lot of young men living together, and secondly, perhaps particularly with Westerners and on Thai, that kind of competitive instinct often comes to the fore, who can sit longer than somebody else, who's tougher, who's this and that. And it can often lead to this kind of wish to get away from Wat Nanachat and go and stay in a branch monastery or go on Tudong, and you know, thinks everything will be better. But there is a beautiful simile that some of you may be familiar with, that is of the rocks, or the small rocks at the summit of a mountain, and the rounded pebbles by the side of the river. And the idea is that when you remove yourself from that kind of low level irritation and sense contact, that you remain jagged like the rock on the peak of the mountain. Whereas living together in a community, you rub each other back and forth. You rub each other up the wrong way, as we say in England. But over the course of time, you become a smooth and beautiful pebble. And the idea that, you know, the real practice is sitting and walking, and everything else is a kind of a obstacle to that, which if you are skilled and diligent, you can minimize the impact of on your practice. It is not, I think, a very intelligent, wise way of looking at it. One of the frequently repeated teachings of Lumpo Cha was that you can only free yourself of something when you see it clearly. Unless you can see it clearly, you never fully recognize the drawbacks, or what we call the toll of something, and that sense of nipitaha doesn't truly appear in the mind, doesn't arise. You have to face up to things calmly and coolly, and look at them and learn from them before you can let them go. There's not like a shortcut where you can just bypass these things usually. So when there are occasions where you feel kind of irritated with this person or that person, then question is, what's really going on here? Well, irritation is arising in the mind. We don't have to, we should be training ourselves to refrain from seeing things in terms of persons, personalities, selves, and seeing things more and more in terms of conditioned processes. So that can sound as like quite a cold-blooded way of living your life, but it's merely a recognition of how things appear to the bright, clear mind. Now you notice the less mindful you are, the more real your personality and the personality of others becomes, the more fixed they become. The more mindful you are, the brighter, the clearer your mind, the more you experience things as process, as flow. And not just yourself and your own physical and mental khandhas, the phenomena, but those around you also. So in the case that there is some feeling of dislike or some irritation or some aversion to someone arising, that's no different from the aversion that arises while you're sitting in meditation or you're walking up and down on your Dzogchen path. It's the arising and passing away of aversion. So if you are keen on devoted to finding a way of transcending aversion, then you have to be willing to observe it and learn from it. As I said this morning, how it arises, what feeds it, what starves it, what eliminates it. So in what we call our daily life and performing our duties and fulfilling our responsibilities towards the Sangha, then there are feelings of liking and disliking, feelings of aversion, feelings of affection. All of these feelings are part of the practice. So you should be able to see a two-way process here. The more that you are able to identify and recognize and let go of hindrances in your meditation practice, then the more you should be able to recognize the mental states that arise outside of the formal meditation postures as unwholesome mental states arising, passing away. So in meditation, the cause, condition of that aversion might be of probably some kind of memory. Whereas in daily life, it might be something somebody does or says, or when they don't do something you would like them to do or don't say something you would like them to say. So that the cause changes, but the actual emotion, the negative emotion, is identical. So there is the arising and passing away of wholesome and unwholesome dhammas in daily life, exactly the same way as the wholesome and unwholesome dhammas that arise during formal meditation. So we can see that it's just the same thing, the same play of the khandhas during the day, from the moment we wake up to the moment that we go to sleep at night. So I think a large part of practice is training in that ability to observe and you observe, and you observe things again and again and again, and then you become fluent. So the word emotion is an interesting word in that there's no exact counterpart in Pali language. So I'm usually hesitant to use words referring to the mind which cannot be translated into Pali, because they tend to reflect a wrong understanding or an incomplete understanding of the nature of the mind. And the very definition of emotion is not universally agreed upon. There are many different ideas of what emotion means, the word emotion means, or what constitutes an emotion. But I think that my understanding, at least, is that emotions are mental states that have measurable or observable physical component or counterparts. That's to say, it's a mind-body phenomena. So in the case of, let's say, anger or aversion, then before we have this strong sense of anger arising in the mind, there are usually a pattern of physical phenomena arising. If you're observant enough of that pattern, then you can cut it off in the bud before the full-blown emotion of anger appears. So there's a physical aspect and a mental aspect. Physical aspect is coarser by its very nature, and will start to manifest even before you're even aware that you're angry or upset. And sometimes it's always usually easier to observe other people. We had a monk here once, he's one of the senior monks, and he had this habit when he was starting to get irritated. You know, he would show in a movement of his arm, and you could look at it, you see his arm, and so you could point it, so he's getting angry. And he would not even be aware so far that he was in that way. So some people will feel this first physical expressions of anger in their shoulders, maybe, in their face, in their chest, in a limb. No, it varies a lot from person to person. But if you can observe that particular pattern, the particular unique characteristics of that emotion as it arises and grows, then you have a way of dealing with it very effectively. So positive, negative emotions don't exactly map onto kusala dhammas, akusala dhammas, but it's more, I think, truer in case of the negative emotions than the positive emotions. But what I really like to stress is this a keen observation of phenomena. And we can often fall into the trap of thinking that the one who evaluates our practice is somehow separate from the mind that is practicing. In other words, we can think, oh, my practice is going very well these days, or my practice is not going so well, or it seems to be stuck in a rut or whatever. So these, but that kind of evaluation doesn't mean that there isn't an objective evaluator. It's just more, it's just another mental state arising and passing away. And you can see, if you observe, how untrustworthy that evaluating voice is. You have a good meditation and you think, oh yeah, I'm going to be a monk for the rest of my life, and you, or this is the life for me. And you have a bad meditation or two and you think, this is it, I just haven't got what it takes and I'll be better off leaving the monastery. So the assessment and the evaluation of where we are in our practice is also part of the practice. It's also part of that which needs to be understood. So in one of the things that I think becomes especially impressive, or something that really can have a strong effect on our practice, is that particularly living in a monastic community like this, we are surrounded by goodness and people performing acts of kindness as a matter of course. It's just normal in a monastery. And these don't have to be spectacular acts of goodness, things that you would want to write home about, but they are really at the very heart of our life in as monastics. So we don't have to be developing like positive thinking as a sort of a way of looking at the world and keeping up our spirits. Simply opening the mind to the goodness all around us is incredibly uplifting. As I said, we can easily focus on our own faults and vices and those of others. Those are the things that have a strong immediate impact. You don't need to observe those kinds of behavior and speech, but you do have to put an effort in often to awaken to the goodness. And in our practice as monastics, as well as observing and rejoicing in the goodness that we see around us, then making that effort to act in a kind and supportive way, as to be a Kalyanamitta to those around us. This is the way that we make merit as bhikkhus, as novices, as monastics, and it's the way that we build bārami. And bārami is the source of the emotional maturity which allows the wisdom faculty to fully express itself. So often people who meditators who are focused on a particular technique have become very technically proficient in meditation. But I think they often fail to make any significant breakthrough because they don't have the emotional maturity that has to form a foundation for insight into the three characteristics. It's like a little bit like you walk to the edge of a cliff and you look over the edge of the cliff, and next moment you realize you've jumped back without intending to. It's just this natural instinctive survival instinct to keep away from the edge of the cliff. And the analogy here is that the cliff face is the three characteristics, and the mind, which lacks that, the stability of samadhi, but also this the long-term effort to create an emotional stability and maturity through devotion to acts of goodness and kindness. That is the significant factor that you draw back, because seeing insight into three characteristics undermines and destroys all of your most cherished beliefs and obsessions. It's not something that you can handle very easily unless you have this immediate sense of well-being and stability through working through all these basic imbalances in the mind, harboring thoughts of resentment and ill will towards parents or benefactors. This lack of generosity, lack of gratitude, lack of the more devotional side of or aspects of the mind. So we neglect those sides at our peril, because this is a practice where all of the different faculties have to merge in harmony. So the intellectual faculty, the moral faculty, the emotional faculty, all these things, they have to blend in harmony. And it's just like pushing hard and relying on effort and determination it's not a bad thing, it's an admirable thing, but it's not sufficient. So there has to be this middle way mind, one in which there is the capacity to put forth effort, even to go beyond your comfort zone, as we say, but also at the same time that sense of relaxation and joy in the practice. So in the Buddha's teachings on the Aryavamsa, the noble lineage, the noble one is take joy in the abandonment of defilement, take joy in this practice. Not just joy in the fruits of practice, but joy in the practice itself. And chanda, dhamma chanda, kusala chanda, is such a vital dhamma to develop. Every time you sit down to meditate, you should just check whether or not there is this quality of dhamma chanda in the mind. this interest, this zest for practice, this enthusiasm, this love for the Dhamma. And if the mind is lacking that quality, then the meditation will be depleted. It's lacking an important quality. Sometimes if you come to a meditation session and you feel kind of low and uninspired, then don't launch into your technique straight away. Spend a few seconds or even a few minutes on developing Dhammachanda. Well, how do you do that? Yoniso Manasikara, wise reflection, means bringing up perceptions, bringing up thoughts, bringing up themes which inspire you. So traditionally the kinds of reflection would be on the Buddha, and maybe you have a fund of stories from the life of the Buddha. There are ones particularly which you always find inspiring, uplifting, or particular Dhamma teachings you find profound. Or perhaps, say, the easiest is to bring your mind to the great teachers in our tradition, from Lungpu Man, Lungpu Sao onwards. We have so many wonderful examples, and of course Lungpo Cha, the founder of our own tradition. And recalling that these monks didn't start off as saints and pure-minded individuals, although, you know, sometimes the biographies of monks would like lead you to think that. But I think, as many of you will have heard, that when Lungpo Cha spoke of his own early life as a monk, he would almost always talk about his struggles and difficulties and defilements. He never spoke in a boastful way. But the reason why he did that was clear. He wanted to remind all of us that he started off with problems very little different to those that all of us are dealing with, and yet he was able to overcome them through practice. You think of, you reflect also all of the countless lifetimes that we have been wandering through samsara in different realms of being, and the birth as a human being is considered an incredibly good fortune because of the human capacity for training and education and ultimately enlightenment, and that we have this opportunity to learn, to study, to practice in an environment in which everything is expressly designed to minimize the obstacles to practice and to maximize the advantageous conditions. And that in this transformation of the human mind from the unenlightened state to the enlightened state, it's the training of the mind following the Eightfold Path, the Threefold Training, which is the engine. And there's no other means. There's no shortcut. There's no other path to enlightenment other than that taught by the Buddha. So when you reflect on this way at the beginning of a meditation, you say that do you believe that there is such a thing as enlightenment, that enlightenment is attainable by human being, as enlightenment is attainable by me? If so, how? Well, through this practice of meditation, through this training, if I'm sincere about this effort for enlightenment, then I must be sincere in this practice of this coming half an hour or 1 hour or however long it might be, because this is where it all happens. The present moment and the dwelling in the present moment is not the goal of meditation. That I would suggest the analogy is that the present moment is the classroom. So we're training ourselves to dwell in the present moment in order to enter the classroom in which we can learn the Four Noble Truths. If you are not in the classroom of the present moment, then you're only learning about the Four Noble Truths. A story and a presentation, a memory, perception. But in the present moment, we have the opportunity to directly experience the truths, the truth of the truths. So when we see that there's really no other path, I mean, if we're not practicing for freedom and transcendence, then what else is there worth doing in the world? Is there anything more worth doing than this? More valuable than this? If our answer is, and I think it should be, no, there's nothing more important than this work. Well, if you don't do it right now, you don't do it this evening, you're going to have to do it tomorrow. If you don't do it tomorrow, you're going to have to do it the day after tomorrow. If you don't do it the day after tomorrow, then next week, not next week, next month, next year, year after, next lifetime. But there's work that we all have to do sooner or later. And so the simple question is, why not sooner? How confident are you either you'll get this kind of supportive conditions again in the future? You know, this, you know, we hear about this, like great good fortune of a human birth, and those teachings and words that we hear frequently, after a while, can just go in one ear and out the other, and we don't really digest them and really feel the full force of what those words should signify for our life as human being on this planet. So the great teachers like Ajahn Chah are witnesses. They are those people who, through their incredible effort, have proved that this realization of the Four Noble Truths, this transcendence, this liberation from dukkha, is not a myth, or it's not something that could only occur 2,000 or more years ago. It's timeless. Ajahn Chah's favorite simile was, it's like water, the water table, that if you're willing to dig down deep enough, sooner or later you'll reach the water table. But if you don't dig well, then that water is there. It's as if it's not there at all. It has no meaning for you because you're not willing to do the work. Another of Ajahn Chah's, Lumpur Cha's similes is like the dog sleeping on the sack of rice. The dog's hungry. It's laying on the rice, but the dog doesn't know how to cook rice. It's just material. It's a pillow, or it's a bed for it to lie upon. So if we, the raw materials are here, but we have to cook them, we have to digest them, we have to realize the truth of them. So motivation is a skill. When I speak to school children, they say, this is boring, this lesson is boring. And I say, no, you're bored. It's not that if the lesson was boring, then everybody would be bored all of the time. But that's not the case, is it? Some people quite like it or like it a lot. Some people are indifferent. But if you're bored, it's because you don't know how to not be bored, or you've never applied your mind to not be bored. There's something which will maybe encourage boredom in someone who doesn't know how to look after their mind. But if you know how to look after your mind, there's no reason why you should ever be bored. I have a personal anecdote pops into my mind. Yes. I was a Pakow in England in 1978, and always with the intention to come to Thailand after the rains retreat. And after the rains retreat was over, I came down to the Hampstead Bihara for a night or two before catching the plane to Thailand. And I thought, I'm leaving the world. I'm never going to go back again. And I just thought, I really want to go and see a movie before I leave the world. And the Hampstead, so there was this kind of arty cinema in Hampstead, which is the kind of the intellectual part of life, where all the sort of intellectuals and professors and artists live. And they were showing this this movie that I wanted to watch as well, called Rinaldo and Clara. And this movie was made, directed, produced by Bob Dylan. So I was very keen on watching this movie, and it's a long movie, 3.5 hours long. So I just spent the whole rains retreat, watching my breath go in and out. And so I sneaked out. I don't exactly sneaked out, but I walked out the Bihara, and I went to this cinema and I watched this movie, and I was absolutely absorbed in this movie. I couldn't take my eyes off the screen. And then I walked out, and they had all these reviews outside. It was like the most boring, indulgent movie ever made, and it's like absolutely slammed by every critic who watched it, because it was like a vanity project, and it was just incredibly boring. And I realized, wow, if you look at your breath long enough, nothing will ever be boring again. I can remember. And this is all compared with watching the fluctuations of a long breath and a short breath and a coarse breath and a fine breath. Even the most boring of entertainments can seem to be wonderfully entertaining. But for going back to school again and children, I say, you have to learn how to motivate yourself. If you're bored, if you just feel you've lost your way, then the tendency is always you want some external inspiration. You want somebody to inspire you. But part of the skill of meditation practice and spiritual life in general is recognizing your mood when there's a sense of constriction and dryness, and when you feel down, and knowing how to deal with that, knowing how to apply the antidote to that, the kinds of reflections, say on Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, or if the mind's very lazy, then the reflection on death. If the mind's getting caught up in sensuality, then the asubha kamatan. There's a lot of negativity in the mind, and the metta pavana. So it's like you have a toolbox of reflections, of discursive meditations, to deal with the ups and downs of your practice. So whatever, the emotional state, the mental state, that's just the raw material. That's what your practice is. You say, I find it very difficult to practice these days because I'm just getting really depressed or really upset about this and so on. But no, it's that state of mind, that's the practice. Exactly that. And dealing with that well. Another analogy and simile from Lumpo Cha is like saying the house is on fire. Where do you train the hose? You train it where it's on fire. I'm going to sort of run away from the fire and train the water somewhere else where it's not so hot and not so difficult. You deal with problems as they arise. In one way you can say that our practice is basically problem solving. So if you're a problem solver and you find you have a certain wholesome pride in being a problem solver, then you don't find problems, the existence of problems at least, as a problem. You're a problem solver. So we're faced with problems throughout our day, things that are challenging us to be greedy or lustful or to be irritated or to be depressed or to be anxious or to be doubtful. These are invitations. And this is, I think, from my observation, as your mindfulness becomes stronger, then there is a sense of invitation. There are invitation to feel mudita for the goodness and kindness and devotion of others. And there are invitation to be irritated by something somebody does or says, or frustrated, upset. But it isn't a simple cause and effect. So physically, it's quite clear that there is simple cause and effect phenomena. If you put your hand into a fire, the fire will burn your hand. And that principle will apply whether you're an unenlightened pitujana or you're an arahant. This is just the nature of human skin and intense heat. But if you, if a number of people are abused, then like verbally abused, then some of those abused people might react very badly and be very angry and hurt. others might be indifferent, others might feel metta. So the fact that there is a variety of responses proves that there's no simple cause and effect phenomena. And so there's an invitation to feel hurt, to feel offended, to feel irritated. There's an invitation to take something personally, or there's an invitation to feel jealous. It's like these things are knocking on your door, but they can't force you to open your door. There's nobody's going to break the door down. For any negative mental state to arise, there's the knocking on the door, but most importantly, there's the opening of the door and the acceptance of it. And this is where, you see, you don't have to answer the door. You can have this feeling that, oh, there's someone's, you know, if I'm not careful, I could very easily become upset with this. Or when somebody says this, or when I can see that if I was to open the door of my heart, of my mind, then I would get angry, or I would get lustful, or whatever. But this is the joyful feeling you have, but I don't have to. I don't have to open the door. I don't have to take that on. And that's where you really get this first inkling of a sense of inner freedom. Yeah, the point is not to escape from situations and from people that you don't like or don't inspire you or not the way you would like them to be. But seeing those all those reactions as unnecessary and things that we are adding on to those phenomena. Or, as I say, you're opening the door and allowing this kind of toxic chemical reaction to take place between the stimulus and the reaction in our mind. Mm-hmm. So keep observing, and observing when you, through meditation, how things change. And that again is very uplifting and empowering. When your mind is very confused, full of thoughts, something can seem just to be such a problem, so worrying. And then after a period of meditation, you turn your mind to that same issue, and suddenly, it's there, it's not disappeared, but a lot of the poison is drained out of it. Yeah, and then you can see that the external situation is one thing, but how we frame it, how we interpret it, what we add to it, these are things that we can deal with very effectively. So, this practice, say, of being part of a community of Kalyana Mitta, this is such a beautiful and wonderful thing. And acknowledging, rejoicing, appreciating each other's goodness, and acting in good and kind ways, because this kind of community, you know, where we have a group of young men living together in this kind of harmony, with this kind of goodwill, where can you find that in the world? I think very rare thing. And so, you know, really cherish this opportunity to live together and to strive together with a shared commitment to sila, and with a shared commitment to right view, and helping each other. We've all got blind spots, we've all got weaknesses,
And as Kalyana Mitta, we want to help each other. So open yourself to admonition. Sincerely appreciate feedback when it comes. Feeling very definition of feedback, you know, it's usually going to be uncomfortable. But if you don't reject that and try to escape from it, and you say, yeah, this is a treasure. This is the Buddha referred to words of admonition from the teacher as being treasures. You should appreciate them as if you received a treasure when you receive a telling off from the Ajahn. Because in the long run, it really will benefit. So these are a few words of advice and encouragement for you this evening, and I would like to end the talk at this point. Mm-hmm.